Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Welcome to this latest episode of the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. My name is Jed Hall, and I'm the Head of Researcher Development at the University of Leeds. In this episode, I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Shepherd, who is the Open Research Advisor in the University's Library. Do you want to say hi, Nick?
Hello, Jed. Nice to be here.
Excellent. And we're both delighted to be talking to Vicky Williams today. Vicky is the Chief Executive Officer of Emerald Publishing, which is a scholarly publisher headquartered here in Leeds, but has international offices across the world. Vicky has been CEO for around 8 years, but she's actually held various roles with Emerald for over 20 years, is it now, Vicky?
25 years,
25 years. That's your 25th anniversary in the scholarly publishing industry, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yes. Now, the genesis of this episode started for me when one of my research impact heroes, and I do a series of interviews branded that on the podcast, with Dr. Julie Bailey. Now, she listed Vicky as one of her research impact heroes. So if you want to find out more, check out that interview with Vicky. It's with Julie. It's in the show notes. Now, although I knew about Emerald's work in developing research impact resources with Julie and her longtime collaborator, Dr. David Phipps in Canada, I really wanted to find out more about Vicky the person and really why Julie had identified her. And I know Nick's been for quite some time wanting to discuss Emerald's work in the open research space and knowledge equity space for ages. So Julie's acknowledgement of Vicky really pushed us into inviting her along today to have a chat. So Vicky, many thanks for agreeing to join us and welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast.
Thanks so much for the invitation. Happy to be here.
That's fantastic. Now, when I was thinking about some topics for the chat, because obviously, you know, Julie mentioned you and I knew about Emerald but didn't know about you, I kind of did some research, you know, that's a good practice as an interviewer. And I had a listen to your interview on the Midnight of the Casablanca podcast and I was like, damn, that is such a cooler name than ours. Where you discuss your career in the scholarly publishing industry. And it seemed to me from that interview and the fact that you've been with Emerald for 25 years or so, that you really must, there really must be a great fit between your motivations and values and Emerald's. So can you describe what they are and how that's been key to your career with them over the years?
Yeah, I think that's really true. And it's probably really unusual these days for someone to have stayed at an organisation for so long. And we see that now as different generations kind of join the business. And, you know, there's much more of a rapid move around. But there has always been a really strong values match for me here at Emerald. And of course, I'm now in a position where I can continue to shape the culture and values of the organisation. When I joined the business 25 years ago, it was much smaller. It was probably less than a third of the size it is now. And it felt very agile. It felt very entrepreneurial. It was also at that stage where it was growing rapidly, both at home and overseas. One of our founders, Dr. Keith Howard, had bought out all of the other founders over time, and he'd become the sole owner. So the business also had a real family feel, I think partly because of its size, partly because of the ownership structure. So kind of both of those things appealed to me in the early stages, that the culture, the values, the family feel, the fact that it was small and entrepreneurial, that really appealed to me. Mm. Also, all of our founders had been academics. So they'd all been academics who had worked in business environments. And they'd all, since the kind of conception of the business, had felt very strongly about bridging the academic practice divide through applied research. So that was there from the off. And that meant we've never played very strongly in the metric space, so we've always wanted the research that we published to be usable in the real world. So that was the other key appeal for me. It always felt like we were trying to tread a slightly different path than some other publishers. One I have to say, which isn't always popular, but one which I could personally really get behind. We're also headquartered, as you said, in the north of England, which being a northerner myself was another key selling point. And that again is really unusual in scholarly publishing, unusual in publishing in general. So I think as I've transitioned into leadership positions at Emerald and more recently as CEO, I've been able to take those founding elements, which really appealed to me, those founding principles, and amplify them. So we've modernized, we've evolved, we've obviously continued to grow, but our roots are still what really informs our culture, values, and practice today. And I think that's really authentic to us and authentic to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being that kind of almost disruptor, yeah, it can be it can feel awkward at times, but yeah, v usually very much values driven in that space. So, and one that I certainly buy into. I mean, I know when I first started doing this job in Research Impact, when I said in open rooms that that's what I thought the purpose of higher education was. You know, when I first started doing this job, the sharp intake of breath was quite alarming. You know, it was almost feeling like I was in the Hurricane Melissa in that kind of
And
moment.
when you layer on a global lens to that as well, it's even more complex. So, there are different kind of structures and approaches to research assessment globally, which can be more or less progressive depending on where you are. So, yeah, it's as I say, it's not always popular.
Yeah, absolutely. And after the interview with Julie, I connected with you on LinkedIn, and then I know, you know, obviously I started noticing the things that you were posting about. And it, you know, there's a wide range of things that really are connected to the publishing industry, but actually aren't about, you know, your business, the turnover, the profit, all of those sorts of things. And there was one about a brainstorming session that you'd had around literacy levels in local communities around where you're headquartered and beyond, and what could be done about that. So can you tell us a bit more about that kind of almost broader pieces of work that you get involved with through your position with Emerald?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this really stems from Keith's vision, I think, in terms of what he wanted a business to be in the community in which it sits. So he, when he was alive, he set up a foundation and always did a lot of community work, particularly in West Yorkshire. So again, those kind of values have always been within the business, and we've always been able to kind of pursue causes, I think, that are kind of dear to our heart, but where we think we can also make a difference. So we work with business in the community in the Yorkshire region, and they approached me to chair a literacy task force because, essentially, because there really is a literacy crisis in the UK. And when you look at that through the lens of some of the most deprived areas of Yorkshire, the statistics are really quite shocking. I think it's one in three children reach secondary school in certain areas of Bradford and Leeds unable to read at the required levels, which is really startling. And there are so many factors that affect that statistic. So we, I do a lot of work on this personally, but again, we've connected that back to the business. So literacy charities are the charities that we support as a business. We do work with the Book Trust, which is a national UK and US charity, and we do some work with an organisation called Chapter One, which basically matches businesses with schools to look at early stage intervention around reading and literacy skills. But yeah, personally, I kind of thought this is something that I feel I can really get behind as an individual, and can use the privileged position I've got and the networks I've got to try to make a small difference. And I'm working on something at the moment with a few other business leaders in Yorkshire, around how we can go back to the roots of community to actually club together to make a real tangible difference to our community. And that's really in its infancy, but I think this is where I think, CSR can move from being performative to actually being actionable and impactful.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And just kind of moving more kind of into our mine and Nick's kind of topic areas. Earlier this year I interviewed Simon Kerridge, so he was edit co-editor of a rather large book about research management and administration. I was kind of stunned when I first saw the book. I was kind of stunned that you could read all 77 chapters completely online for free. And in that interview, I kind of asked him about that. And he said that Emerald were really about the only publisher that they'd approached who were really serious about that kind of open access, and what it really meant in publishing. And therefore the open access processing charge was actually doable for them in that space so that they could make it available to people. So can you take us through maybe your business rationale for that, your approach to open access with books like that, and why that's important to Emerald?
Yeah, and it's quite simple, really. I think, I mean, with any book or with any journal proposal, we'll first of all look at fit with our program. And this particular one ticked many boxes because it aligned really well with the wider impact work we've been doing for some time, as well as giving us the opportunity, I think, to support a community we really greatly admire in research management and administration. As you well know, you work with these people. This is a community that really embodies the notion of co-creation, and it's been a real pleasure to work with the community over the years. Great reaction to the book, which showed us we'd done the right thing, and obviously it's probably the most comprehensive, 77 chapters, the most comprehensive global account of RMAs available at anywhere. So, from a program point of view, from a publishing program point of view, it absolutely ticked all of the boxes. And from a community point of view, it ticked all of the boxes. So then we just go from there and say, okay, what is the business model that we can support? And obviously, Simon, his co-editors, they wanted this to be fully open access, which we got fully on board with. I don't think we created any special conditions around the publication of this book. So they had it secured some external funding that made it possible to publish the whole volume under Creative Commons CC BY attribution license. And then obviously that provides the platform to make the book as, have the widest possible impact, which is what we're all here for. So I don't think there was anything special. We would approach every project in that way, because we have a philosophy that we have an open route for everybody that wants it, and that's not always possible and it's not always desirable, but we do have a route for everybody that wants it, and I think with this one, for both parties, really, the project worked really well, and we were really honored to be the chosen publisher for this book, because I think it's a fantastic volume, a real labor of love, I think.
Yeah, one thing you never know with almost you don't get an impression of is almost the scale. I mean, the scale in
Yeah.
terms of how many authors, how many editors, the regional editors, and things like that Simon took me through. But you don't know how thick it is if you were to print it out. So
I
one day
know
I'd
exactly.
love to be able to see a hard copy of that book just to see if it's really, really
It
thick.
must be. It must be a proper doorstop.
Yeah, brilliant. I'll hand over to Nick now because I know he wants to explore a bit more in this space.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jed. And it's really fascinating to hear your values, your personal values, and as a business in the context of publishing and open access publishing. Because I think perhaps sometimes working in the library in open access, there can be a little bit of a sense of us and them with the publishing industry at large. You'll be aware, our colleagues listening may be aware that there's an ongoing negotiation at the moment with the Big Five, as we call them, which I won't name now, but the Big Five publishers who tend to dominate the market in publishing and have done for many years. And it's expensive, it's hugely expensive. And there's various business models that we're exploring, whether that's Diamond Open Access, and there's non-profits, there's businesses and the values that you have. So again, I suppose just to, I'm not at the sharp end of open access as much as I was in the past, and but certainly, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was more involved in that side of things. And you always had, for example, I don't know if you still do, I'm guessing you still do a zero embargo policy
Yeah, we do.
on green open access. So I don't know if you could say a little bit about your perspective working in the industry around your values again, and how that relates to open access and your perspective on the industry at large, perhaps, if that makes sense.
I mean, the first thing I should say for listeners is that Emerald is a publisher in the social sciences space. So we predominantly publish in business and management, broader social sciences. We've got a bit of STEM, but not a lot. In we've got an engineering portfolio, but it's not a big part of our portfolio. And we have always published a completely global author base. And you might think that sounds like a strange thing to say because all publishers do that, but I think close to 50% of our authorship comes from the Asia Pacific. So we had expanded into emerging markets quite early, and we've always wanted to support a really equitable approach to authorship. So it's worth having those two things in mind because A, there isn't an equitable global position on open access, and there isn't an equitable discipline position on open access. So social sciences tend to be much less well funded, as do certain parts of the world. So we had to really take a step back from that position, as well as understanding where our customers were on that journey. And every customer is at a different stage. So what we've done is we've always tried to develop models and approaches that work for our communities. As I said, obviously in the social sciences, not necessarily funding rich. We also wanted to ensure that we sustained equity in the system wherever we could. So our green open access policy has suited many institutions and many authors thus far because it is zero embargo, and it was seen as very progressive at the time in which we kind of launched it. You've got journals models really dominating the discourse, I think. And it has become, unfortunately, a volume and scale game. So the smaller publishers, I would say we're medium size, and then there's a whole range of publishers who are much smaller than Emerald, that might publish in a very niche area. Transformative agreement models don't necessarily suit kind of publishers or customers when you're operating at that scale, because your publishing outputs won't necessarily be huge, but you'll still want read access to all of the content that is published. Equally, as I say, that is not a smooth picture globally. And actually, in some parts of the world, open access is still not taken very seriously. It's seen as vanity, it's seen as predatory. So you've got a really complex picture there that you're trying to deal with. And as I say, journals dominate the discourse. When you start thinking about books, and books play a really significant role for our communities in social sciences, particularly monographs, the principles should be the same, but I'm sure we'll come back to this time and time again. It's the incentive structure really that prevents progress often. So as I said to Jed, we say we have an open route for everyone, depending on need, depending on funding. We'll have that conversation often at the outset of the process, particularly with books. We can control that from the start. We can have that conversation with journals. It's a bit more difficult. We can be really flexible. We can look at options for article or chapter level, obviously. We can look at full volume open access. But I think, the challenges are far more systemic for me, in terms of that complete flip to an open world, because not everybody is moving at the same pace. Not everybody is ideologically in the same place either. So you end up with a halfway house, which I think is pretty much where we've ended up at the moment, with certain parts of the world much more progressed on the open access journey, other parts of the world much less so. And then you end up recreating, I think, conditions that we had many, many years ago, where the Western discourse dominates your publication outlets. And that doesn't sit comfortably for me. So whilst it's very messy behind the scenes to operate many different business models and many different kind of author and editor needs and community needs, the shift hasn't been wholesale for a reason. And I think we need as a sector to work together to look differently at this, because I think the current models are not getting us to where we want to get to. So, yeah, I'm not sure if that really answers your
Well,
question.
I mean,
Yeah.
I'm just as you're speaking, it's kind of there's different sort of things pinging off in my head around this. It's hugely complex, and I'm not that familiar with your business models. As I say, I perhaps would have been 10 or 15 years ago, and evolving, presumably. I mean, I don't know if you do operate diamond models
We
or
do. Yeah, we do.
is it hybrid and pure gold? I mean, do you have a range of.
We've got the whole gamut. So, as I say, we've got a path for anybody that wants. If someone just wants to essentially, put their work into their institutional repository immediately after publication, that route is probably what the majority of our authors want to do. But we do have some transformative agreements. We have a diamond program. We've got a program of a number of journals. Again, I would say mostly from the Asia Pacific and the Middle East. So that's not necessarily been a demand coming through from the UK, the US. People can publish in open access in our hybrid journals as well. So there is an option for anybody that wants that option. It's just I think what we find is that if this is happening at researcher level, all of the systems don't often join up. So they don't often know where to get the funding from, or they don't know if they've been mandated. We don't know who to bill. It's not as simple as it on the face of it sounds, which is why transformative agreements, I think, have taken hold, because in theory, you've got a mechanism there to actually say, here's your threshold of open access publishing, or it's unlimited, so you don't even have to worry about it.
But of course, that's problematic as well at the moment, and that hence the negotiations. And as I suppose it's really interesting, to have this type of dialogue with you and Emerald, in the context of open access publishing. Again, just to return to that sort of us and them discourse that can dominate a little bit, I think, in library. So you'll be aware of, I think, the Rights Retention Initiative that Leeds and the N8 and many other universities in the UK are pushing, with some pushback from some of the big publishers and international publishers. So again, that sort of reinforces this sense of us and them, when actually, that sort of values-based approach of yours is much more fertile ground for for discourse. And just to, to follow up on, I suppose, the equity question, again, presumably, we could talk about it. I'm really interested to dig into this perhaps another time. But do you presumably operate things like waivers for the Global South,
We
perhaps?
do, we do, yeah.
And there's all sorts of different ways that are, as you've touched on, don't necessarily work. But I was always also really interested. I think the first that I was in touch with your colleague Tony Roche a
Yes.
little while ago, in the context of we here at Leeds are co-founders of something called the Knowledge Equity Network. And again, values-based, my personal values, and I think, library and institutional values are towards sort of knowledge equity. A lot of the work that we do is around that. So we did actually have a chat with Tony around your Are You In commitments, which so perhaps you could tell us a little bit about those and what the sort of rationale and the progress is. I think some of them are still pending, aren't they? Just looking at them, they're
Yes,
not
they
sort
are.
of, I don't
Although
think.
I think there's probably a bit of updating we need to do on the website, to be fair. So yeah, I can give you an update on some of this as well as the background. So I think this was really born from our desire to move from, I guess, philosophy and intent to tangible action. Hopefully encouraging some community effort as a result too. So our position on equity is really deeply held within the organisation. It's really extremely important to us. It's very, very important to me. And in terms of how we run the organisation itself, it's really a key tenet of our culture and our values. So we wanted to ensure that our organisational makeup was reflected in our products, our services, our business models, and our ways of working with our customers and wider communities. So we launched our Real Impact Manifesto in 2018 to illustrate our commitment to broader impacts, to knowledge mobilisation, to knowledge equity. And the Are You In campaign was a natural development from this. I guess for us, it was also born from a level of frustration of good intention, but lack of real change when it came to challenging legacy metrics as well. So we were trying to kind of provoke a bit as well. We started with what we felt were six tangible ways the wider sector could challenge conventional practice and where we could challenge it specifically. So firstly, championing alternatives to traditional metrics and rewards. So this meant seeing things like the impact factor in context. It meant recognizing alternative research outputs, something that we'd actually been doing for a while, but which needed and I think really still needs much wider adoption. And that was probably, one of the bravest things we've done. And again, that might sound strange to you guys, but we in 2018 or just before, we decided that we weren't going to promote our impact factors anymore. And when I said at the start, there were some unpopular moves we made, that was probably one of them because there are parts of the world, and even parts of the world that you would be surprised about, or certainly when you get down to individual institutions, where that metric still really dominates. So I'm sure that it has affected our authorship over time, because people are being pushed to publish in certain venues, and publish with certain publishers that really follow that metric quite doggedly. We decided, given our history, given our roots, that wasn't a metric that suited us, and actually we didn't really believe in it. So although our journals will get impact factors, we don't kind of aggressively move in a direction which would kind of support those impact factors moving upwards. So that was the first big piece, which we continue to this day. Then there were commitments around disseminating research to a wider audience through new forms of content. Really, at the moment, only academia engage with traditional academic outputs. So research communication through different vehicles became really key here. But again, this links to incentives and reward because it's really difficult to find frameworks in which these alternative outputs count. Very much work in progress. Developing equitable, accessible ways to publish was another commitment. So, looking at things such as representation across our editor and editorial board networks, as well as our authorship. And more recently, we've been doing a lot of work on neuro-inclusive publishing pathways. So, looking at neurodiversity in academia and how we can support that through the publishing process more clearly. We also wanted to highlight and reward examples of research that's driving real change, which we do through our annual Real Impact Awards. So these recognise areas such as research which is mobilised into action, interdisciplinary research, research which drives the impact agenda forward. And then finally, kind of co-designing services which help to develop healthy impact practices, which was really focused around our impact services offer, which was developed with Julie and David, as you've already highlighted. So these, in essence, were all commitments we could make and we could action, and they were commitments which would stretch us. But I think we remain really conscious that we can't operate in a vacuum, and actually we're quite a small player in the industry. So to create change, this needs community-driven action. And a publisher can't take the wheels on that. It's got to be the sector that takes the wheels on that. So our call was really, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Are you in? We've currently got just over 500 signatories across the globe, which isn't a huge amount, really. So we've been talking about how to ramp this up again going forwards. But I would say there is, some level of passivity in terms of how the sector responds to some of these things, particularly, I think, when it's coming from a publisher, which, as you say, has been an adversarial relationship at times. And I think probably all publishers are lumped into one bucket as well, when we're all quite different and diverse as well.
No, yeah, and I mean, I've been exploring them and will continue to do so. Just before I hand back to Jed, though, just to pick up on, we used talking about impact factors. I mean, that's a tension in the university, in the Russell Group University as well. We are signatories to DORA, the San Francisco Declaration on Research Assessment. I'm guessing Emerald will
We
be.
are, yeah.
So, what about COARA? We haven't yet, I don't think, committed.
No, I don't think we have either yet, but.
But again, there's a tension there within the university as we need to pr promote some of these metrics as well. And just finally, before I do hand back to Jed, so those 500 signatures, are they organisations or individuals or both or?
Mainly individuals. There are a few organisations on there, I think.
So it is posed as a question, are you in? I'm in. What can I do? Or, as an individual, and as a member of an organization, I suppose, is there a quick sort of.
So I think that, that is the question we're asking people to think about. I think there are, in terms of our commitments, I think there are things that individuals can do to support. So there is the impact factor question, can you challenge that within your institution? Can you influence the way that research is assessed, looking at different frameworks and how they are evolving? As you say, kind of signatories to DORA and other things that kind of support that dialogue. Can you think about supporting different research outputs when you are thinking about collection development, for example, as well as ensuring that they are recognised and evaluated and rewarded in a similar way to traditional outputs? Can you take advantage of the free resources that we've got on impact literacy? We've got a plethora of free resources there, which have been co-created with the absolute experts in the world. You know, Julie and David's couldn't be more famed for what they do in the community. And those resources are, as I say, that they're mostly free. They help universities and researchers to think about research practice and impact practice. So it doesn't have to be big strides. It can be small incremental steps. But I think unless we're challenging the way things are done, we're always going to get what we've got because, you know, the structures are not changing to support ultimate change.
No, that's great. Thanks. And back to you there, Jed, I think.
Thanks a lot, Nick. Yeah, I mean, all of the things you've been saying kind of really demonstrate just how important research impact is, and that kind of almost founding principle from your founders, in terms of we're not just about pushing out research stories, but actually making and, you know, those research stories making an effect somewhere. So, you know, just can you take us back to why they were really that was really important for them? You said they were in the business and management field. You know, there's tensions often in the in with colleagues in that space, in terms of I really want to head in the kind of theory direction because that might be chasing the metrics, whereas you know, theory is difficult to immediately apply, so is it makes it quite hard in an impact sense. So can you give us a sense of that and how you kind of, you know, you've given loads of examples about how you're keeping that bat on and going forward with it, with the impact towards signing the publisher's Sustainable Development Goals Compact and all the other things that you've just mentioned. But you know, right at that values level, and you know how that gets communicated to authors when they're approaching you.
Yeah, I mean, going back to our roots. So we were founded by, as I said, a group of academics. They were all at the University of Bradford. This was back in the 60s, so I think the impact factor wasn't as big a thing in those days. As I said, they'd all worked in practice, and really, Emerald was born out of some frustration that they couldn't get access to the management literature that they wanted to read. So they, you know, they acquired one journal, which is still one of our, you know, oldest and you know, most kind of high profile journals. And they grew the portfolio from there, really, based on their own need as practicing academics. Who all wanted their own research to be used by practicing managers, you know. So that has always been our founding principle, the steer that we've had with any kind of new product launch, new journal launch. You know, that's always been our philosophy. So I think we are known for that, but as you know, when I joined the business, certainly, which was back in 2000, I think we had got caught up in some of the metrics game a little bit, because that was what was driving authors to publish, you know. So of course you're trying to do the things which suit your communities. But what I think then we did was realize that actually the research we're publishing, it is very applied. It's probably never going to have a really high impact factor, because actually what we're saying is we want this research to be used in the real world, and the real world practitioners are not going to cite that research. So you're kind of then, okay, we're not doing what we said we would do, which is create research which can be used. So we just took a pause and really went back to those roots. And whilst we, as I say, whilst we, all of our products or most of our products will have an impact factor, we look at that in a context. It's in a basket of metrics, and we say to our authors, we are the publisher for you. If you work in these disciplines and you are mission focused, if you are wanting to reach different audiences with your research, we're not the publisher for you if you are researching in a highly theoretical space. And I'm not saying there's not a place for that. There's absolutely a place for that, but we're not that place. So you take our roots as that baseline, and then maybe over the past kind of 12, 13 years, we've started to align with what we're seeing happening in various markets, as well as seeking to kind of push that dialogue, as I was saying to Nick, and act as a bit of a facilitator of change in the publishing space. So going back to the research management community, I first got to know that community and Julie in particular about 12, 13 years ago. So we'd acquired a research communications agency. I was running that down in Bristol in the UK. So we started to attend the RMA events globally. And I think that's when everything really clicked for me, because here was a community really talking our language. They were talking about championing wider impact. They were talking about embedding inclusion in the system. And I started to get really interested in the intersection across RM functions at universities, how they interact with the library, who are traditionally our customer as publishers. So they're traditionally our purchaser. And the editor-author communities, which is obviously our key stakeholder. And that's essentially when we transitioned our position from research you can use to real impact. And articulating that, I think, started to make the follow-up actions a bit easier. So, as I said, the first step was being bold enough as a publisher to say, we're not promoting impact factors anymore. And you may not like that, but that is who we are. And we're going to stay true and stay fast with that. The second was that collaboration with Julie and David on our impact services platform, which was again to support the wider community in impact literacy. And then more systemic for us was embedding this in our publishing program. So you mentioned the SDG Publisher Compact. We've really aligned our publishing program to horizontal mission-based grand challenges rather than subject verticals. So that was a big shift, ensuring our commissioning activity reflected that shift, and embedding that in every part of our workflow. And we're still not there yet. I wouldn't say, if you were accessing our content, it wouldn't necessarily be obvious from a product perspective, but that's where we want to move to. So it's always been, for me, a really big part of who we are. And when we've lost our way, we've kind of moved back to it every time. I think now we're just articulating it slightly differently. We're listening to our communities, we're co-creating with them. And that is the essence of who we are. And it's really exciting to work in that way. It might not always be the most commercially successful way to work, but it's very authentic and true.
Yeah, that's interesting. That must be real tension sometimes, when you're I don't know whether you call your finance person, chief finance officer comes to you and goes, the graph's heading downwards or whatever the language they're using. It must be interesting in times like that when you kind of go, do we hold our nerve and hold on to our values, or do we have to alter course somehow in that space, knowing that survival of the business is actually crucially important to maintaining the values.
Absolutely, and that will always be a tension, I think. And there are some things, a number of things we do that don't have a tangible return on investment, that don't have a tangible payback. But that doesn't stop us. I think it's finding that balance, isn't it? And trying to make sure that we're doing the right thing without destroying the business. And I think we've got that balance about right, I think.
Yeah, brilliant. I think just a final thing from me before we maybe start to wrap up and thank you for coming along. Was really around that kind of you mentioned all the different actors in the system, and the different almost influences which actually, you know. The metrics kind of take on a life of their own. They're only an influence. They only become powerful because of how people choose to use them or not use them. And you mentioned reward and recognition and this, that, and the other. So what would your call to us, as a different part of the system, specifically me, specifically Nick, specifically our leaders in at the University of Leeds, what would be your call to us in the university sector, knowing that funders are another part of the system and people who assess are another part of the system, can be, depending on where you are in the world. So what would your call to action be for us now? What would you want us to do next?
I think it's being brave and bold, and it's really holding the line, isn't it? Publishers will never unlock change on our own, and certainly, one publisher is not going to unlock change on their own. And as you've said, as you've very, clearly articulated, they often have a pretty bad reputation as academia, as publishing has profited from lack of change in the system, and I think that's the very honest view. And change is really hard, I know that. And when you've got a really big unwieldy system like academia, it's even harder. And I know from having friends in the sector, it's a really difficult place to be right now. So lots of restructures, reduction in staffing, reduction in funding. It's really hard. And like many sectors, academia is having to do more with less. And that makes change even harder because why do you want to layer on something else that's going to mean more hours and more disruption. So it's probably not really for me to ask or to advise, but I think the worst thing that you can do in times of change is retrench to old ways because it's easier. I think being bold during times of change is really hard, but it can also really create the conditions for key pivot points. Personally, I think we need to start working together more as a sector to trust each other more. And I know that might sound crazy to some of your listeners, but there are good guys in all parts of the system, and there are good guys who really want to create positive change for everybody that's there. So I think working together more, thinking about how we recognise and reward all forms of content, all forms of scholarship, which, as Julie would say, those outputs create meaningful change in the real world. So that's what we need to be focused on, is that meaningful change in the real world. So that means we need to get comfortable with different outputs. We need inclusive research environments that won't look or feel the same, even nationally, never mind globally. So it will be difficult to assess them like for like. And we probably need to get a bit more comfortable with non-linear career progression as well. We need to be less obsessed with metrics and rankings because who are they really serving at the end of the day? And I hope all of those things are not a dream. I hope that I see some of that change in my lifetime, but it does feel slow. It does feel like you're fighting a tide, I think, often. You've got these pockets of real innovation, real kind of change makers, but they are pockets. They're not, it's not systemic, and it does need to be systemic.
Brilliant. Thanks, Vicky, for that. Yeah, it is a big challenge, but we've all got to be try and be positive, optimistic, work together, and that's where we can support each other to maintain that optimism when our different parts of the system are being under, are under pressure, or the pressure is increasing in that part of the system. It is mates essentially that keep you going, isn't it? People who are your good collaborators. So
Absolutely.
thank you for agreeing to the chat today. It's been lovely to find out about more about you and Emeril. And Nick, do you want to say thanks as well?
Yeah, no, it's been fascinating. We could disclose more questions I'd like to ask you, and perhaps we will, off air, as it were, and collaborate. And it's been, really interesting to hear your perspective, and
Yeah,
yeah, look forward to ongoing conversations.
we're just down the road, Nick. So yeah,
Yeah.
anytime. Yeah, that sounds good.
No, thank
Yeah,
you.
we'll all have to get together for a coffee. And Vicky, I'll leave it as it is coffee time. We're recording this kind of in the morning in the UK. I'll leave you to say goodbye to our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me, Jed and Nick. And yeah, I hope that was interesting. I really enjoyed the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.